The automobile age promised freedom and self-fulfillment, but according to our next guest, it has actually imprisoned us. The average American now spends 16 weeks of his life stuck in traffic, impoverished us. We spend more on cars than food and health care combined, and eroded our communities. 40 years ago, half of all American children walked or biked to school. Now 5 out of 6 get driven. The demand for oil is fast outpacing the world supply, and it is time to start imagining a world after the automobile age. That, according to award-winning author Taras Gresko in his new book, Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. Taras Gresko, thank you very much for spending time with us. I greatly appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe.
What got you thinking about automobiles and the impact that they have on us?
Well, I've never owned one of the things, and I spent about the last 20 years as a travel writer visiting the cities around the world, looking at how they cope with their transportation problems. And the most sort of advanced cities, the biggest metropolises, have already given up on the idea of the automobile as a form of public transportation. And they're looking to things like streetcars, metros, new forms of light rail as a way out of their congestion problems. So I thought I'd go out into the world, visit cities like Moscow, Copenhagen, Tokyo, even unexpected places like Bogota, to see how they were dealing with their issues and bring some of those ideas back to North America.
Did our car culture ever make sense?
Of course it made tons of sense, and it still makes sense to a great extent. I mean, I was not immune to it as a teenager. It was all the dreams of freedom. You know, for a relatively small outlay, you could have a car that would take you anywhere on the continent. We built a fantastic network of freeways, one of the largest in the world. But it never made sense as a form of urban transportation. In spite of all of our efforts, there were guys like Robert Moses in New York who tried to shoehorn the car into the city, a city that was built for and functions best for walkers and subway riders, strap hangers as I call them. Los Angeles is probably the best example because they turned their arterials and boulevards into freeways. It was a city that was formed by rail. It was formed by streetcars and interurbans. But it was converted starting into the 50s into a city of freeways. And right now they're desperately trying to reverse engineer their way out of it by building new subways and light rail. And to a large extent they're succeeding. There's going to be a subway to the sea, or a subway that will go to Santa Monica within the next few years. And they've raised the money for that with a tax that was voted for by a popular referendum. So, I mean, the car as tool of escape, the car as a way of, you know, the Bruce Springsteen dream of blowing out of your small town, that always had appeal and will continue to have appeal. And the car is never going to go away as a workhorse, as, you know, a carrier of loads. But I see its role diminishing in cities in the years to come.
And you do write about the long-running war between the private automobile and public transit and how it has shaped our cities. Do you feel that the automobile use being in decline is now one of consciousness or necessity or both?
It's a strange sort of phenomenon where a lot of different things are coalescing. Starting in 2008, we saw incredible price hikes in gas, and that doesn't seem to be going away. You know, gas was under a dollar for most of the 90s. It's up to 4 times more expensive now. We're seeing a generation, the millennials, who now outnumber the boomers, who are comfortable with living in cities. And that might have started way back with Friends and Seinfeld and all of these shows that showed city living as fun. And the fact is that they're not buying cars anymore. There are far fewer driver's licenses issued to teenagers now than there were 10 years ago. And many of them, well, about half of them, say they'd rather have a smartphone than an automobile. And that's a huge change from when I was a kid. So I think it's a durable trend, and we're seeing it in the sheer number of people who are getting on subways and buses and trains. For example, the New York subway, 1.6 billion rides a year now. That's the highest it's been since 1950, and that kind of ridership is being reflected in systems around the world. The challenge remains, however, to improve those systems, because a lot of them remain, frankly, undesirable. They're just, you know, people don't want to take them because the trains and buses don't come often enough. But the more people that ride them, the better the service can become.
Picking up on that, why do you think there has been, in addition to what you just mentioned, this stigma attached to subways and streetcars and even bikes and walking?
Yeah. Well, we associate bikes with sort of leisure activities on the weekend. We don't, like the Europeans or the Asians, see them as a way of getting to work. 36% of people in Copenhagen get to work or school by bicycle now. And the stigma goes back a long way. I mean, people call the bus the loser cruiser. It often is a loser cruiser because it's just stuck in traffic. It's the biggest vehicle on the road. It doesn't move very quickly. But there are a lot of schemes out there called bus rapid transit that are making them load faster and move through the streets faster. And when you're sitting in traffic now, stuck in congestion, stuck in a traffic jam, and you've seen a bus in a dedicated lane that's zipping past the traffic, all of a sudden the stigma attached to that disappears. And you realize that some of the buses and Amtrak trains are now equipped with Wi-Fi. People are getting their work done. They're texting. They're communicating with their families. These are things they can't do while they're driving cars. Well, they can text and drive, but that's very dangerous.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's a question of changing the status of these things. One very intelligent mayor in Bogota set up this system called Transmilenio. It's a city where only 20% of people own cars, and he said, you know what, why do cars get most of the street space? The people who are trying to get to work on buses should have priority. And he set up a brilliant system that that did just that, that made the bus the most efficient way of getting around town. And subways certainly are fantastic for that kind of thing. And if you haven't ridden a subway or a light rail in your city in a while, you should check it out because the experience has gotten a lot better.
In your traveling and in your studying of these systems comes great promise and great optimism because there are places who are doing a great job.
Yeah, definitely. Everywhere from Shanghai, which has built the world's biggest subway system, in the last 16 years or so. It's now bigger than Toronto's. It's the best way to get around the city. Tokyo, which was a city built around its trains and subways, 800 stations in the area, in the megalopolis, which means it matches the anywhere-to-anywhere connectivity of the personal automobile. And it forms a very different kind of city, one where, you know, you don't have to cross so many major thoroughfares or take your life in your hand when you're going across a big street. I guess the most interesting case study for me was Moscow, which is a city that is completely paralyzed by traffic. They had one traffic jam in the winter where the entire city was shut down. It snowed, so people had to come out a few days later to shovel their cars out of traffic. But they say that the tailbacks, the gridlock, if it was lined up, would stretch all the way from Moscow to Barcelona. Mm. While this was happening, I talked to people who had experienced it, and they said the only thing that kept running was the Soviet-era metro, which effectively, conveniently, and in stations where there's great public art, chandeliers hanging from the ceiling, moves 9 million people a day. It's incredible. It's sort of the clockwork that keeps a lot of cities running, these old legacy metro and subway systems. And the cities that are expanding them have done the math. The next stage is to serve the suburbs, however, and that's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge just because of, as those areas become larger and larger and larger and further and further and further from the cities, we're talking about a lot of miles.
We're talking about some American cities, you know. I mean, if you added up all the pavement in the United States that's devoted to the parking lot, I think you get something like the state of Georgia. It's big. But there is hope. I've talked to experts who have looked at models around the world. They look to Toronto, which is a Canadian city, which is with a population of 5.5 million and a lot of sprawl. They do a very good job of serving their suburbs. They only have a three-line subway, but what they do is they send out feeder buses into the suburbs. They're intelligently scheduled, so they respond to demand, and they mesh very well with the subway system. And that might be a model for sprawled American cities like Atlanta, Houston, even Phoenix. You know, a lot of these cities are building their own light rail. What they have to do is think about getting the buses out there that will link with the light rail and make that whole system work. Subways are great, but I don't think, you know, we're going to see city-wide subways in places like Phoenix, Atlanta, and Houston in the near future. It's a huge investment. We have to find other alternatives. Bus rapid transit is a pretty good one.
So in the perfect world for you, the fate of the automobile would be what?
I think we'll continue to use automobiles. I happen not to own one. I use the equivalent of Zipcar in my city when I want to pick up furniture or go out to the suburbs to see the in-law. But the automobile, we're already experiencing demotorization in North America. People are buying fewer and fewer cars every year. What's going to happen is we're going to see situations more like what I saw in Tokyo and Scandinavia, where people own cars, but they use them to go out for drives on the weekend. They'll use them to go out to, you know, the seashore or to a lake or whatever. It'll be more about pleasure driving, and for the practical day-to-day heavy hauling of commuting, they'll start using better designed commuter systems. And I think that makes a lot of sense. That's what I'd like to see. The car is too useful an invention for it ever to go away, but for it to have become our go-to mode of commuting doesn't make a lot of sense, and we're seeing the result. It's costing the U.S. economy, according to the Treasury Department, $100 billion a year in wasted time and gas, the fact that we're relying on these things. There's so many other great ideas out there around the world.
The name of the book is Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. Tyrus Gresko, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. Best of luck with the book.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Strap Hanger. It is published by Times Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.